Hello, lovely True Crime Dimes. You might have deduced from its title and the fact that it's a true crime podcast that the show will cover potentially upsetting content. In addition to detailed accounts of all manner of horrendous acts, this podcast will also entail the vital and varied use of curse words, BIPOC allyship, love for the LGBTQ+ community, using people's correct pronouns, and other pretty liberal shit. If any of that's gonna upset you, exit now. This is Trigger Warning, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Jen O'Malley, and you've been warned. Helle Nielsen was born in Denmark on Monday, July 7th, 1947. She was an only child, raised in a small town north of Copenhagen. Helle was a pleasant and successful student who did well in all her subjects, but showed an aptitude for languages. She mastered English, French, and while I can't find confirmation anywhere, I assume Danish, and could converse in German, Swedish, and Norwegian. According to the book Cracking Cases, The Science of Solving Crimes by Dr. Henry C. Lee, Helle matured into a tallish and thin, ash-blonde young woman, one who continued to make friends effortlessly. The other young women Helle met soon grew to trust her for her sincerity and her discretion. She was very private about her own relationships and had no interest in gossiping. Her excellent posture, high cheekbones, a pronounced dimple in her chin, and broad smile made her, without any single feature standing out, a very attractive young lady. Richard Crafts was born in New York City on Monday, December 20th, 1937. Growing up, he was an average student. He was average in every way, actually. But at just a few months shy of 19 years old, Richard joined the Marines in August of 1956. Over the next few years, he became a member of an elite Marine drill team and a pilot, specializing in helicopters. He was eventually stationed in Korea and Japan and made 3 sea tours with his squadron and had volunteered for assignment to Air America, the air arm of the Central Intelligence Agency, which was conducting clandestine military operations in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. When he left the military, Richard was hired directly by Air America, and he stayed with them for 4 years. He then took a variety of for-hire flying gigs and was hired by Eastern Airlines in 1968. Since we talked about how Helle looked, let's talk about Richard's appearance for a sec. Just in case you're picturing a guy like The Rock or something, stop. Richard was 5 feet 8 inches tall, slight, and scruffy. It's like if a not-hot Sam Neill and Mr. Rogers had a baby. Kinda. Helle loved to travel and accepted her first airline job as a flight attendant for Capital Airways when she was 20, flying out of Brussels and Frankfurt. In 1969, she replied to a Pan American World Airways recruiting ad, one of the more highly respected carriers of its day, and one that attracted a cosmopolitan, even glamorous workforce. Helle was selected and sent to Miami for training. That's where Helle and Richard met when he was sent there to recertify on several models of Eastern's aircraft. The two dated on and off for years, even though Richard was engaged to someone else. When Helle discovered that she was pregnant, the pair got married on Saturday, November 29, 1975. They bought a home at 5 Newfield Lane, as well as an undeveloped 3.6 acres on nearby Currituck Road, and went on to have 3 children, 2 boys and a girl. By all accounts, Helle was an involved and loving mother, whereas Richard was aloof and violent. While, as a pilot, he made more than twice what Helle earned as a flight attendant, her income was used to pay the household bills, and Richard's was used for his hobbies, guns, he owned over 50, landscaping equipment for projects he never finished, an apartment in New York, and whatever else struck his fancy. One major expense for Richard was his odd fascination with law enforcement. His prized possession was a 1985 Ford Crown Victoria, just like the one the Connecticut State Police used, that he'd equipped with lights, sirens, radios, and antennas. He was a volunteer with the Newtown Police Force, and he'd pay his own way to very expensive training conferences, like one in California held by the Lethal Force Institute. Later, in 1986, he'd leave this volunteer position for a constable role with Southbury, just north of Newtown. It paid $7 per hour. Quite a difference from the approximately $89 per hour he was making as a pilot. Some of the actual police officers took issue with how serious Richard was about his duties and his desire to be a super cop. Between flights, shifts with the police department, and training seminars, you might think that Richard wouldn't have had time for much else. but he also traveled to gun shows and spent hours on their properties cutting wood and splitting it into logs. He apparently didn't spend much time with his family. In cracking cases, Dr. Lee notes that Richard was frequently absent from home or otherwise unavailable for attending parent-teacher conferences, birthday parties, and other traditional times when a father should participate. In 1981, Crafts was off somewhere when Hella went into labor with Christina and, deciding not to bother anyone, or perhaps out of embarrassment, Hella calmly drove herself to the hospital for delivery of her youngest child. The Crafts' neighbors also did not see much of Mr. Crafts, though Hella was easily accessible and became particularly close to several. For planning purposes, Hella always posted her schedule on a calendar, though her husband seemed to come and go on a random basis. He would disappear for days on end. In 1984, Richard was diagnosed with colon cancer. He had some lymph nodes, part of his liver, and a foot and a half of his colon removed and successfully underwent chemotherapy. Hella was by his side through it all, and she felt that this brought them closer than anything ever had. But you know what they say, once a cheater, always a cheater. Richard had affairs prior to and throughout his marriage to Hella. When he regained his pilot's license in 1985 and his flight schedule went back to normal, so did his philandering. Most recently, with a flight attendant Hella knew, Nancy Dodd from Middletown, New Jersey, who Richard had apparently been seeing for years. Hella had had enough. Between his violence towards her and the children, his absenteeism, and his inability to remain faithful, she was considering ending the marriage. During the summer of 1986, Hella sought the advice of experienced divorce attorney Diane Anderson, who told her to get proof of Richard's adultery and recommended private investigator Keith Mayo, a former police officer. Since Richard did the absolute least when it came to covering his trail, Keith easily obtained photographic evidence of Richard's latest affair. Paired with phone records, credit card statements, and receipts, Hella had solid grounds for divorce and finally told Richard that she wanted one. Richard appeared to take everything in stride, but in November, dodged several attempts by deputies to serve him the divorce papers. He also told Hella that his cancer was back and that he wouldn't fight it again. She called his oncologist and found out that Richard was lying. The only thing eating away at him right then was the potential cost of child support, alimony, and dividing their assets. Hella grew increasingly concerned for her own safety. Because of Richard's police connections, she was afraid that if she left with the children, he'd find them, or that he'd claim kidnapping in an effort to gain full custody. So she stayed, but told her closest friends and her lawyer, "If something happens to me, don't assume it was an accident." Even with the divorce process moving along, the family had plans. Hella loved the holidays, and their calendar was packed, from hosting Thanksgiving to a family ski vacation for the five of them in January. Hella had even planned a small birthday party for her friend and fellow flight attendant, Rita Bonanno, to be held during their upcoming layover in Germany. The return flight from Hamburg on Tuesday, November 18th, 1986, was an hour late due to headwinds. Hella and Rita rode with Trudy Horvath. It was Rita's turn to drive, but her car was in the shop, back to Newtown, a one-hour trip. On the radio, reports of a large storm approaching the area worried the women, but it seemed they'd all be home before it hit. During the ride, they discussed their holiday plans, gifts they'd purchased, and even mundane things, like Hella remembering that she needed to pick up the uniforms she'd had altered, and that her nanny was working that night at McDonald's and wouldn't be home until very late. They dropped Rita off first and arrived at the Crafts' residence around 7 p.m. Hella observed Richard's home, got out of the car, loaded her heavy flight bags and the presents onto a cart, and went inside. The snowstorm was unseasonably early, big and unexpected, with heavy winds and lightning. The snow was wet and heavy and caused considerable damage to tree limbs and power lines. The power went out at 3:35 a.m. Richard woke Marie, the nanny, around 6 a.m. to tell her that he was taking her and the kids to Karen and David Rogers' house, his sister and her husband, in Westport, because they still had power. Marie asked about Hella, and Richard told her that Hella had already left for Westport and they'd meet her there. When they arrived, Hella wasn't there, so Marie asked Richard about her again. He snapped at her that he didn't know where Hella was, so Marie let it go. Richard then returned to his home in Newtown. The power came back on there at 10:44 a.m., but when he spoke with the nanny just past noon, he told her that it was still out. Around 3 p.m., Richard called his sister to say that he'd be later than expected because, even though the power had been restored, he'd gotten stuck in his driveway. The entire situation made Karen suspicious from the start because she knew that, one, Richard had a portable generator, and, two, he was a capable driver in any kind of weather conditions. She assumed he was using the power outage and storm as a cover to spend time with another woman. Rita and her husband Frank were still without power, so they drove to the grocery store. They noticed the lights were on at the Crafts house. Rita had tried to call Hella several times that day, but never got an answer, so she tried again once she and Frank returned home. Richard finally answered and told Rita that Hella wasn't there and he didn't know when she'd return. When Rita informed him that their power was still out, Richard offered his home for hot showers. Rita did not take him up on this. Hella didn't return Rita's call that evening, so she tried again in the morning and Marie answered. Once again, when Rita asked after Hella, she was told that she wasn't there. Rita asked where she was and Marie said that she must be flying. They ended the phone call. But Rita thought about it and realized that Hella couldn't be flying. Regulations required a 48-hour stand-down between flights, so Rita called back. Are you sure Hella's flying? Marie said that she must be because her flight bags were gone. This made Rita anxious. After all, Hella had told her that if something happened to her, Rita shouldn't think it was an accident. Rita blurted, I'm supposed to do something if she's missing. Marie assured Rita that that wasn't the case. Richard called Rita later in the day. He told her that all was well. He'd just gotten a call from Hella in London. She'd left the morning of the snowstorm for Denmark because her mother was very ill and in the hospital. But Rita knew that Hella had spoken to her mother when they were all in Germany just 4 days earlier, and she'd been fine. Richard said that Hella would be coming home on Tuesday, November 25th. The next several days leading up to and past Thanksgiving were full of phone calls and conversations. Here's what you need to know. On Thursday, November 20th, Rita asked Richard if he'd called Pan Am to request emergency leave for Hella. If she missed 3 consecutive flights and was unreachable, she could be fired. Richard asked Rita to do it. But Pan Am's policy was that Hella or Richard had to request a leave and it had to be done by Monday, November 24th at 5 p.m. Also on Thursday, November 20th, Rita asked for Hella's mother's phone number. When she called it on Sunday, November 23rd, she found that Richard had given her the wrong one. On Saturday, November 22nd, Rita arrived for a flight, one that Hella was also supposed to be working, and saw Hella's Toyota Tercel in the Pan Am employee parking lot, but Hella failed to report. It was the first flight she'd missed in her 17-year career. Rita returned to New York on the afternoon of Monday, November 24th, only to discover that Richard had still not requested leave for Hella. She called him multiple times and urged him to act, plus asked to get Hella's mother's phone number again. He gave her the same one. On Tuesday, November 25th, Rita used a language assistance operator and called the number again. The person on the other end verified that it did not belong to Mrs. Nielsen. Marie, the nanny, reported to Rita and Frank that on Thursday, November 20th, Richard had been examining a list of phone numbers Hella had posted in the kitchen, as well as her address book. The list, Hella's address book, and Marie's own address book, which included Hella's friends' phone numbers in case of emergency, disappeared. She was convinced that Richard had taken them. On Tuesday, November 25th, Marie told Rita that on Saturday, November 22nd, she'd seen a dark-stained patch the size of a grapefruit on the master bedroom rug. A few days later, Richard had taken up the rug. On Wednesday, November 26th, Rita once again called Richard. She asked for Hella's cousin's phone number as well as Richard's sister's. He wouldn't give her either one, claiming that he was too busy. Thanksgiving came and went with no word from Hella. On Friday, November 28th, Hella's car was still in the Pan Am employee parking lot. Rita ran into Lena Johansson Long, another Pan Am flight attendant. Rita, Lena, and Trudy went to the employee cafeteria for coffee. During their talk, they discovered that Hella had told multiple people to not believe it was an accident if something happened to her. Hella and Rita shared a post office box because they had a lace curtain business together, not relevant to the case. And Rita had found a receipt for the retainer Hella paid her divorce lawyer. She asked Lena to contact the lawyer while she and Trudy were on assignment to Zurich. Hella was supposed to be on this flight too. It was the second one she'd missed. Lena was Swedish and could communicate in Danish, so on Saturday, November 29th, she called Greater Copenhagen Information and got the correct phone number for Hella's mom. Treading carefully so as not to alarm her, Lena confirmed that Mrs. Nielsen was not sick, Hella was not there, and she was not expected there until April. Later that day, Lee called Richard to confront him about Hella not being in Denmark as he'd claimed. He first tried claiming that Mrs. Nielsen had lied, then that Lena had misunderstood her, and finally he suggested that maybe his wife was with her friend Vivi in Paris. He didn't know Vivi's last name or phone number. On Sunday, November 30th, Rita spoke with Richard, and he said that Hella might be at a Club Med in the Canary Islands with her pal Helen Dixon, or maybe Betty Bell. Obviously, Hella's friends were suspicious and really felt that Richard had something to do with her disappearance. On Monday, December 1st, 1986, Diane Anderson called Keith Mayo. She explained that three of Hella's friends had left messages for her over the weekend and filled him in on Hella's disappearance. All three of the callers had also been worried about Marie Thomas's safety, since she was now the only other adult in the Crafts' home. Keith Mayo reported his client missing. Richard explained all his actions with, "I lied because I was embarrassed that my wife left me," while Hella's friends loudly proclaimed, "That's bullshit. She'd never leave her kids. Richard did something to her." Newtown police seemed unbothered that an adult, multilingual, experienced traveler was missing. Whether this was in support of their old pal Richard or simply a typical response, I can't say. Either way, the state attorney's office was frustrated with their lack of cooperation and on Tuesday, December 23rd, decided that the investigation would be handled by the state police exclusively and instructed detectives with the Western District Major Crime Unit to draw up a search warrant for the Crafts' home. The search warrant was executed on Christmas Day and continued through December 28th. Richard and the children were visiting his mother in Florida. Some of the items gathered were a live hand grenade, which was immediately disarmed, a large hunting knife, a Beretta crossbow, and many guns, including several Smith & Wesson 357 revolvers, a Walther PPK handgun, a Colt 45, a Finnish Seiko pistol, a few 38 revolvers, a Browning semi-automatic, a Winchester rifle, a Beretta 9mm, a Thompson submachine gun, Colt Python 38 pistols, Ruger carbine rifles, Finnish semi-automatic weapons, 12-gauge pump shotguns, a Heckler Koch 45 pistol, and an over-and-under style universal shotgun, plus numerous clips and an assortment of ammunition. Photographs of deep tire tracks in the yard, photographs from inside the trunk of Richard's Crown Vic showing piles of wood chips and missing matting, a section of the mattress cover from Hella and Richard's bed, washcloths and a towel, and the Ford Crown Victoria itself. When the case was taken away from them, some of the Newtown police had actually been looking into Richard's recent credit card purchases. On Monday, November 10th, he'd ordered a brand new $15,000 dump truck from a local dealership and asked that a special rear hitch be installed. He wanted the truck ready for delivery on Tuesday, November 18th. On Thursday, November 14th, Richard drove into New York State to buy fireproof gloves and a flathead shovel. He also purchased a chest freezer for $375. To be picked up on Monday, November 17th, and reserved a large wood chipper to be picked up on the 18th. He bought $257 in new bedding on Wednesday, November 19th. Newtown police never wrote any of this up and made no mention of it to the Western District Major Crime Unit, who didn't find out about these things until Monday, December 29th. They also discovered that three witnesses had spotted the wood chipper out and about. Joe Williams was driving across Silver Bridge around 7 p.m. on Thursday, November 20th, when he saw a running wood chipper attached to a U-Haul with a man crouching between the two as if he didn't want to be seen. That bridge, officially known as State Bridge 00507, links Glen Road in Sandy Hook to River Road in Southbury, crossing the Lake Zora section of the Housatonic River. Joey Hine, a snowplow driver with the town of Southbury, had also seen the truck and machine parked on Silver Bridge. Hine described how a man in an orange parka had stepped out from behind the vehicle and directed traffic on the bridge since the wood chipper was partially blocking the road. Richard Wildman was a part-time Southbury constable who'd given the man with the wood chipper a ride around 4 a.m. on Friday, November 21st. He identified that man as fellow part-timer Richard Crafts. Joey Hine took the detectives to the exact location he'd seen the wood chipper. According to Cracking Cases, the detectives quickly saw coverings of wood chips on both banks. They looked like they'd been spread around by a pitchfork or a shovel. Mixed in the wood chips, they saw pieces of a light blue material and scraps of paper. Two detectives climbed down the bank and saw what appeared to be an envelope, which had a small nick in it. The envelope's return address corner carried the words American Cancer Society. Both men remembered that Crafts was a recovered cancer patient. Being careful not to touch this evidence, they looked through the cellophane addressee portion of the envelope and were able to make out a name, Hella L. Crafts. One detective secured the area, while the other took Joey Hine back to town, then drove over to where his unit had established a command center. After he announced their discovery, Several detectives headed to the bridge, where they immediately found other pieces of mail, nicked in places, bearing Hella Craft's name and address. Investigators picked up the exact wood chipper Richard had rented and took it to the state lab for testing. Meanwhile, the blood on the mattress cover had turned out to be type O, the same as Hella's. In his book, Dr. Lee remembers, "We melted the snow inch by inch and separated the leaves and debris from potential evidence by hand. The forensic team and detectives collected more than 24 bags of evidence. Once a potential piece of evidence was found, it was photographed, documented, then sealed in a manila envelope. This meticulous work was done over a 2-mile stretch of the Lake Zor banks. These shreds of evidence included, gruesomely enough, strands of blonde hair and tiny bone fragments, which proved to be human bone. A Shackley vitamin label was an item collected which no one at the time recognized as that significant, since we did not yet know that Hella Craft sold this type of product. All of this evidence was seized and taken to the Westport Barracks and then was transferred to our forensic laboratory. Most of this critical evidence was discovered on a Tuesday, exactly 6 weeks after that earlier gray day in later November when Hella Craft said, 'Richard's home,' as she got out of Trudy Horvath's car to go inside her home for the last time." He continues, "Our team's efforts at Lake Zor eventually led to the discovery of 2,660 strands of blonde hair, bleached, 69 slivers of human bone, 5 droplets of human blood, 2 teeth, a truncated piece of human skull, 3 ounces of human tissue, a portion of a human finger, 1 fingernail, and 1 portion of a toenail. This overall search would produce the final evidence needed to arrest Richard Crafts for the murder of his wife, Hella Nilsen Crafts, on or about November 18th, 1986. Okay, Dimes, we've covered a lot of information so far. Before we move ahead, I want to fill in some holes and give you the investigator's theory of what happened to Hella. First, a simple clarification. Why in the world was Richard driving around one of the most conspicuous vehicles ever with the wood chipper attached? Well, remember that dump truck he'd ordered? That he asked the hitch to be installed on? That's what he'd planned to be driving. It's a Ford F-350, so it's got a normal cab, but an industrial-style bed that tips. Through a series of unfortunate events, the dealership couldn't get the truck to Richard on time, so they loaned him the U-Haul. Why'd he bother putting her mail into the wood chipper? Well, as part of Richard's "Hella voluntarily abandoned us" lie, he'd told detectives that she regularly received 1 to 2 pieces of mail a week, but hadn't gotten any since she'd left. He felt that this sufficiently demonstrated that she'd taken off on her own, as she must have arranged to receive her mail elsewhere. As far as what happened to Hella, investigators believed that she arrived home, put the kids to bed, then got ready for bed herself. She and Richard got into an argument, and while she was putting fresh sheets on the bed, he came up behind her and hit her in the head with a police flashlight. Hella fell to her knees, this is how her blood was transferred to the mattress cover, and then Richard struck her again, a fatal blow. Richard put his dead wife into the new chest freezer he'd bought. Early the next morning, he woke up the nanny and the kids and took them all to the Rogers house. He came back home to clean up as much evidence as he could and waited for Hella's body to freeze. Once it had, he dismembered her with a chainsaw, possibly at the Currituck property where he habitually cut wood, and put her body parts through the wood chipper in several places across Newtown and Southbury, finishing up at Silver Bridge. He disposed of the new chest freezer. The one police found and searched while executing the warrant was his old chest freezer, as well as a chainsaw, after he'd attempted to file the serial number off. Ridiculously enough, considering all the new things he purchased to kill his wife, Richard used a chainsaw he already owned, and police were able to match the serial number to a warranty card he'd submitted 5 years earlier. He then returned the wood chipper and dropped the U-Haul off. He did some other shady shit, like try to bribe a non-American couple to say they'd seen Hella at a drug party, but if I detail all of it, we'll be here forever. Much lawyering happened after Richard's arrest, a very tedious jury selection, then a change of venue and a new judge, requiring another jury selection. It was a lot. Finally, in May 1988, the case went to trial with an overwhelming amount of forensic evidence, but no body, only pieces of one. On Thursday, June 23rd, 1988, it was time for the jury to decide. 22 days later, they were still deadlocked due to one holdout, the only juror who wanted to acquit. It turns out that this juror, Warren Maskell, didn't abide by the code of conduct as he was meant to. His wife was in the courtroom each day, and they'd discuss the case in detail, as well as go home and watch news reports about the trial. A woman who was sick of trying to change a guy could just take off and say the hell with it, Warren explained. I think Hella Crafts might still be alive.
Without her skull, sir?
Warren finally defied the judge and walked out of deliberations, forcing a mistrial. A second trial was held, and after just 8 hours of deliberation, that jury found Richard Crafts guilty of murder and sentenced him to 50 years in prison. Due to a statutory good time law that was in place at the time, his sentence was significantly reduced for good behavior and work, and Richard Crafts was released to a halfway house in January 2020 at the age of 82. As of June 2020, he's no longer in the custody of the Department of Corrections and has served his time. That's it for today, y'all. I'd like to shout out my latest patron, Joey, the love of my best friend's life. Thank you for always supporting me. Speaking of Patreon, if you join at any level between now and August 13th, you'll get access to a special live chat on my Twitch channel so that we can get to know each other. Also, I've dropped merch for the very first time. Free shipping starts tomorrow and availability is limited, so get yours now. Go to merch.twtcpodcast.com to see all the sweet designs. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a rating or review. You can also contact me on social at twtcpodcast on pretty much every platform if you have any suggestions or feedback. Just a quick heads up, I've switched release days. As you know, I just started this show and I'm still trying to figure out what works best for me. Thanks for your patience as I figure things out. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, Dimes.